All right. So this is, I think, more or less the end of imaging, unfortunately. But I've tried to select a few topics which hopefully are interesting for imaging. Yeah, but I won't talk about imaging, but I will talk about dynamics in what...
Hopefully.
This is, I think, one reason why we are here, to learn from you imaging guys if this is of interest or not, or what would be of interest. So I called it photo-activated Coulomb complexes, and that's kind of because we are theoreticians and we would like to generalize things. And the general observation is, whatever happens, you create charged particles. And if you look roughly at what you do, you create nothing but charged particles. And charged particles, if you treat them classically, which we will do all the way along in these extended systems with a lot of energy deposited, they have very nice properties because the Coulomb force is homogeneous and you have scaling properties. So that's one little exercise I will try to do at the blackboard to show you that from the scaling properties follows some self-similar dynamics, which means you can relate certain basically parameters like pulse length, excess energy, size of your system, and so on. And so they are not independent of each other and lead to the same dynamics under certain restrictions, of course. And this will be the second point. And the first point, I would like to start just with some general remarks how we view what happens basically to an extended system, biomolecule or a cluster. We mostly will take clusters. It's easier for us as physicists under intense X-ray pulses. And in the end, I will be a bit more specific how one could possibly reduce radiation damage. Probably not to an extent that it will be sufficient to make imaging possible right now, but at least to give you a feeling what dynamics can do or what possibilities there are which might not have been seen so far. And essentially, reduction of radiation damage means for ion dynamics, this is what I will address in that point, of course, to tame the Coulomb explosion. I mean, photo ionization or coupling to X-ray photons means you remove photoelectrons. There's no way around that. This will certainly happen. And that means you create positive charge that will eventually lead to Coulomb explosion anyways, because you have a very small space, lots of positive charge. And the question is how to get rid of this positive charge. If you don't have positive charge, then your ions or atoms, whatever, they will stay around. Yeah, they will not move a lot. And then you can take your images. It's like to say, hold still for longer to the ions. And there are two possibilities. Of course, you can try to replace these photoelectrons, which go away, by other electrons, which you have to get from somewhere. This I will try to show, supply screening electrons. And a second possibility, which is a bit more strange and which we discovered recently, and we're not sure if this is really a possibility, but you could also try to get rid of positive charge. How would you do that? Well, there's positive charge around, like protons or hydrogen atoms, a lot in biological samples, and these you're not interested in. You don't want to image them anyways. And if you can transfer all the positive charge to the protons and let them explode, they go fast because they are light, then you get remove like positive charge out of your sample as well. So that might be a second possibility, which it actually maybe is even more relevant for biological samples, how to get rid of this positive charge, which you create inevitably by doing photo coupling at X-rays through the removal of the photoelectrons.
I always thought the problem with the hydrogens is that you couldn't see them with X-rays. Neutrons or whatever, but in principle they are of interest.
No, the hydrogens are not so much of, I don't know,
hydrogen
maybe.
Bonding and so on was, I mean, I'm not a biologist, of course, I'm wondering that you said this so plainly.
John, what do you say? You want to see the hydrogens?
Hydrogens are usually kind of...
Cannot be seen anyways.
You have adapted to that. I mean, this is how I learned.
It's very interesting. Actually, one of the arguments for the neutron source is to try to see hydrogen.
That's what I thought.
But
for proteins and so on, it's not necessary.
I understand that it's not really a threat.
So it's not C1, it's
exactly.
Top down.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just the hydrogen bonds which play a crucial role.
I'm going to see that.
You want to see the I? So you can leave in the end of the talk, it's okay. No.
So I would have, I think Tim mentioned the new NMR techniques, residual,
yeah. Well, I guess there are problems where you're not so important and which we also cannot solve right now. And of course, there are other problems where you want to see the hydrogen.
And the other question is whether if the hydrogens leave, whether that has any indirect structural impact on a sufficient.
Yes.
Initially, it didn't, right? But it's, at some point, it will have a structural impact on the rest. So even if one argues that one can't see the hydrogens.
No, I mean, it will have a structural impact, but much later normally, because it, you know, depending on the ratio of the masses. So on. That's probably fair to say, roughly speaking. I will show you. Yeah.
But for a large system, for the protons to get out, they kind of, I mean, they would have to find the right channel to move through.
Ah.
Isn't that right?
Not necessarily. There are also electrons around. You might get screening effects from that. At least as far as, I mean, from the smaller systems we have looked at, admittedly some hundred, you know, molecules, which I will show you, there's no effect of that kind so far. But I guess it will be very hard to see the protons anyways by any X-ray techniques, right? Because they are so light, and once they are ionized, they will go first and they will go fast. So it's really, really hard to see them, even if you, yeah. And they scatter very weakly, as you, because that's why you don't see them in the first place. So I guess for X-ray experiments, it's a fair statement to say you want to get rid of them and use them because they're useless anyways. Use them to remove positive charge because I don't see a chance to actually image them with X-rays. Maybe other methods.
But
right?
Will they put them ionized first?
No, they are transparent. But I mean, you create so much charge in the course of your exposure to the X-ray beam from the heavier atoms by photonizing them, that they will be removed by field ionization,
uh-huh.
The electrons. They are weakly, relatively weakly bound, 12 eV, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Or something like that, or in a molecule bound. Okay, so since I see already I probably won't come to the end, let me thank all the collaborators in the beginning. And that's of course first of all Ulf, who has been instrumental over almost the last decade developing all that in our group. Jonas was here last week, he is now at UC Irvine. And Christian just finished his PhD, turned in his thesis. Alexei will do so soon. And Vitaly was distinguished postdoc with us, came from Lenz Cederbaum and is now at Imperial College in London. He also did nice work more on the quantum domain with clusters. I will not talk about that. Imperial. No, Imperial is IC.
It's IC.
Imperial College. Oh, we have to take that out, it's broadcasted now. And then there's well, they used to have maybe an emperor, yeah. Imperator, that's a Latin word, right? No, okay. Then Pier Francesco just joined us from Italy, and Michael Winter is also working in this area as a PhD student. Okay, so let's get to the general scenario, and I think I should do that on the blackboard for you. So, so we have, as a first step, of course, we have atomic photoionization. Yeah. So this will be very qualitative ionization. And so you have your sample, let's say for us it's a sphere, it's a cluster out of, let's say, the same sort of atoms right now, but doesn't really matter. Could also be some non-homogeneous kind of biomolecule or whatever for these considerations. And now you generate kind of at arbitrarily positions positive ions, yeah, by coupling to your X-ray photons. And in the next step, if you have generated enough of these positive ions, you will get field ionization. And that's something Ulf emphasized a lot. I will do so as well, because this has been overlooked until now, more or less, in most of the modeling. Field ionization, and it's very general, and always occurs. Of bound electrons, let's say, bound electrons from surface atoms. That happened first. So what this means is, essentially, you have your surface here, and now you create here all positive ions, and not by photo ionization, but by field ionization, because these electrons which you gain now, they are not lost. Yeah, they go inwards towards the positive charge you have already, and they will kind of screen the core here. There's some more holes you have created which is not screened, but they will screen this core, as many as you get depending on the strength. So that's kind of the second stage.
What about collision ionization?
At this point, this depends if your system is huge, this might happen, but remember the photoelectrons are relatively fast. So it's much more likely that Auger electrons will collisionally ionize, and they come a bit later.
But cannot those free electrons cause impact ionization?
Yeah, that's what he means. But these, you mean the ones liberated from the field? Yeah, but they are relatively slow. I mean, this could happen, but I mean, we have a general problem in modeling that. One should admit that right away in all models. And this is, if you consider, let's say, an average field which is generated, which is like slowly varying, and you consider field ionization, let's say mostly over the barrier, which is sufficient, then this contains part of any impact ionization you would model, at least for the valence shell. So you would double count if you would do impact ionization by some kind of rates or whatever, or yeah, Born cross sections.
At least on
the
surface.
Wherever. Doesn't matter. You have a field everywhere. It's just strong. It's time dependent, but it is averaged over all your charges, so it's more slowly varying than individual orbitals of electrons. So you can take it kind of static like you would do in an IR field, yeah, at the moment for a bound electron.
So let me just comment on the collision ionization. So I once looked at the stopping power for a 12 keV electron in diamine, and that was about 0.6 eV per angstrom, which means in about 20 angstroms, enough energy has, so to speak, been lost to ionize an atom, right? So about 12 eV lost per 20 angstroms. So if the object has a radius of 100 angstroms, so it would seem that on the way
you will get there, you will get some effects. But this is much, much stronger. This is orders of magnitude stronger. You will get maybe one collision event.
No, what I'm saying is you get about 10 collisionally ionized electrons per outgoing 12 kV photoelectron.
No. It gets slower then. I mean, you lose energy and you would have to.
Could you put a time scale on those two stages?
I mean, this depends, of course, on your pulse, on the intensity of the pulse, how fast it rises. Yeah, it depends on how fast you create holes here. And it depends only on the critical charge per atom you create once the ionization sets in. Depends on the pulse. Let's say in a typical really intense pulse, it's on the order of 1 or 2 femtoseconds. It starts well before Auger processes. That's kind of important to distinguish and also to say that this plays a role. So I would say, yeah, this is of the order of, let's see here, 1 femtosecond. Yeah. It is true that the impact ionization, that's kind of something which is not consistent in the models, I would say, so far. Because, as I said, it's very hard to combine field ionization, which is there, which is physical, with impact ionization in modeling. Okay, so then we have a third step. And this is, I would say, around 5 femtoseconds. This is, again, average number. This is when Auger comes in. Okay, you know that Auger is different depending on the element and so on. So this is now Auger decay of electrons. holes, and now you get secondary electrons. And they kind of act like field ionized electrons. I mean, they thermalize anyways, yeah? That means also these Auger electrons, they will be trapped very soon. They are much slower, yeah? They cannot escape as compared to the photoelectrons, so they will also go to the center and screen the center. And at this point, latest, you really have a thermalized nanoplasma, yeah? Of electrons. In a way, plasma formation sets already in here. As soon as you have free electrons, which stay, of course, in your system, yeah, and scatter and so on, collide with each other, exchange energy, you start to form the plasma, and here the density is high enough that it has really formed and thermalized. And that means now you have a situation where essentially you have an outer layer, which might be relatively big, where it's all positive charges. The ions might be multiply charged, and this is more or less perfectly screened here. Of course, it has a certain thickness. It's not depending on temperature and so on, the spill out of the electrons, if you wish. But it's relatively sharp. And here, eventually, you might even start, depending on the size of your cluster, to start to see trapping of photoelectrons. If your system is big enough and you have created enough positive charge, even photoelectrons with their KeV energy will not be able to escape anymore, are also trapped and contribute to this nanoplasma. But this is relatively late, and in terms of help for screening and so on, it's kind of useless because they really come too late in almost any case. Okay.
One question.
Yeah?
The pulse is about femtosecond.
The pulse is here, let's say, of the order of 10 femtoseconds.
So when all this happens, the pulse is still there.
The pulse is still there.
So ionization continues.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you create holes and so on. We've discussed that frustrated ionization last week in atoms, yeah, that you pump your holes dry eventually. You need to wait for the Auger decay to happen to fill the 1s shell again. Yeah. So actually, in the course of the pulse, you might actually get reduced ionization, photoionization, because you don't have so many filled 1s shells anymore.
Probably always one positive, so I'm not sure, but then the characteristic Auger lifetime, so the elements as well.
Why?
Because then you're certain that you're always beating the Auger decay. I mean, once you have ionization, then you have to wait until Auger decay has taken place to refill the inner shell, so you could, in principle, reduce the...
Not necessarily, because if you could say you actually want to have... Yeah. I don't think this is... There are so many other things which happen that this is only one consideration.
But, I mean, you would probably want to have a short pulse in any case because there's going to be some motion involved, atomic motion. I mean, it's not necessarily going to be a Coulomb explosion, but there will be some smaller scale motion possibly. Maybe not so much the macroscopic motion, but small scale motion that one may not want to average over.
I think that's a question. You might also go for a very long pulse with low intensity if you can manage that the objects you want, the micro objects, stay around. Then, you know, being soft, longer exposure might also get you a good image. It's like in real photography. Pardon?
Thermalized.
Sorry. Yeah.
If the inner region is then it just means that the pulse is not reaching there anymore.
The pulse is always reaching, or basically objects are so small that the penetration depth is not a point. What this means that it's screened, that is that you actually avoid or reduce Coulomb explosion of your positive ions to a large extent.
But in a way it will also modify, the electric field, right?
Yeah, you have balanced electric field, but you can still have photons. I mean, the wavelength is too short at X-rays. No, no, it's
too high.
It's
not
it's,
enough.
It's
yeah.
No.
High enough.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, you actually want the cohorts to be filled, right? In order to get scattering, because it's the electrons that scatter, and if there's a cohort, this upsets the picture. It actually makes the so what I'm saying is, I'm agreeing with you that if Auger decay takes about 5 femtoseconds. It's good to wait until the process has taken place, because that fills in the cohorts.
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, you also scatter from the valence electrons as long as...
When you have Auger, then you have 2 electrons at the atom. When you have Auger decay, one goes in the core, the other is lost from the atom, so you lose an electron effectively.
Yeah, you lose an outer electron.
Right? The cohort, so what? If
it's bound...
If the molecule is charged somehow, these outer electrons are more or less like nucleus.
Mm.
As good as co-electrons, more or less.
Seems like it might even be advantageous to turn off the absorption by having occasional electrons.
Yeah, that's what
you
say.
So you might be better.
Yeah.
It's not like the form factor of Hado ion is zero.
No, it's not that. It's just that the Hado ion tends to
scatter a little less than high resonance.
Right, that's right. Which is a problem.
When do you see that you can distinguish between the valence electrons of an element in a shell electron? You can basically distinguish once your resolution can resolve atomic structure. That means interatomic structure. When you can distinguish basically between the outer and the inner shell electron, that's the resolution you need to see the drop of the form factor.
So in all the scattering, the bulk of the electrons are at the atom core. So this is why we get atomic structure, because most of the scattering is in the core. I mean, it's true there are valence electrons, but their density is quite low compared to the core electrons. So the core electrons are the crucial ones.
You cannot tell the difference between one and two
electrons. I mean, what is is 100% correct. You just have a form factor which cuts off, but the natural length still is, of course, I mean, it's a Fourier transform of scattering and density. And if the interatomic distance is larger than that, you're not really limited by that.
The form factor. The form factor is an envelope on the reflection path.
Absolutely.
So the form factor
envelope,
is more narrow.
Have
no information.
Yeah, but that envelope goes down as what I said. So it's so high Q, it's inverse to the length scale.
Mm.
And if you have a carbon-carbon bond of 3 angstroms, and what's a carbon-carbon bond?
1.4.
So you have to compare the core radius. But I mean, if you come up with the structure, you can see that, then you're very good in modeling. But it should not really function.
No,
it doesn't go to zero.
But the crucial point is that the atomic form factor is an envelope on the reflection path.
Sure.
So the form factor becomes narrower, you are losing high resolution.
No, that's true, but you're starting to lose that resolution basically at the cube, where you're starting to resolve the individual structure.
That's why you don't want to do that.
The question is, do you want to resolve the individual atomic structures, or are you happy with a resolution that resolves interatomic distances? It's not the same thing. Already a higher resolution that you require.
All right. Yeah. I guess we cannot resolve that right now with any kind of resolution.
Can I ask a stupid question?
Yeah.
So inside your charged plasma, is it possible to have electron excess, or do you always go at most to charge equalization? It's a very stupid question.
I think you go to at most equalization, yeah. I haven't thought about it, but I wouldn't see a possibility because the electrons are much lighter. They would, repel each other. And actually, you have an electron spill out because of that normally. So your electrons extend a little bit more over the positive charge sphere, if you wish. Yeah.
So I just want to come
in
with
the
one.
Oh, no, come on.
So my understanding is that
the first ionization is the first choice.
small end of the energy. Well, covalent action diffraction, it's a really interesting model, which means a resolution volume, which is inside the resolution volume, all these electrons, the scattering intensity is proportional to the n squared and the number of electrons inside the resolution volume. When resolution is low, the resolution volume very, very large. When resolution is high, the resolution volume is small, small, small. You have to get atomic resolution to come out.
What happened?
can you also draw, I mean, you have drawn pluses where the ions are. Can you also draw minuses where the electrons are?
Yeah. And the electrons are kind of this this smeared out sphere here. Yeah, and the other ones are...
And number two, they're still near the pluses there, right?
No, there's.
Moving inside.
I mean, the pluses, let's say, are at this point more or less homogeneous. Yeah, you have kind of random photoionization events, so you have a certain density, positive charge density, and as many electrons as are available, screen the inner part of this positive charge density to neutralize it, more or less. That's the idea. Of course, this is not complete because you have lost photoelectrons, right? Therefore, you have this outer positive kind of shell.
So does this imply that the thickness of that ion shell that is kind of function of the photon energy?
Yes.
They bring more and yes. more electrons out as one brings up the photon energy, so to speak.
Yes.
Because one gets the more energy.
Yes. And now, of course, you have Coulomb explosion, all your outer ones explode, they are gone, the ions. That's important for the idea of a tamper, yeah? And this, what is inside, is protected. So let's say if your system were homogeneous and you would be only interested in the kind of near structure of your system anyways, you would be already done. Because the only thing is you have to look at the central part. Yeah? This one doesn't interest you, it's the same. And you would image that and that's fine, it stays intact. Of course that's not the case. If you want to have the whole object, you should cover it with someone you can actually lose or sacrifice. That's for the Coulomb explosion. Let's come to that.
Part is electronically hot. I mean, all the electrons are trapped in there, but it's not cold.
Yeah.
So, I mean, one cannot exactly say it's, so to speak, completely unaffected by what has happened.
Nothing is completely unaffected once you come in with the photo beam. I mean, what you want.
The question is whether if one images that image structure, whether it corresponds to the structure, say, at let me say, 2-angstrom resolution, whether you would get, so to speak, the same scattering pattern from that inner relatively hot ball of plasma, whether you would get the same scattering pattern at 2-angstrom resolution.
Yeah, you get the background from the plasma electrons, which gives you the size of this plasma ball, roughly. And this is, of course, the first big difference, but that you're not interested in, and I hope you could discriminate, right? And then the next question is, you have two things. You have, of course, electronic damage and ionic damage, if you wish. Electron damage you have already, big ways. We have discussed that now all along, yeah? And this will have changed a little bit, of course, and depending on the resolution, it has changed a lot or not so much. In 8-angstrom resolution, it hasn't changed at all, I would say. 1-angstrom resolution, it will have changed quite a bit. But the question is what you want to image. If you want to image structure, like proteins or so on, I think you don't care. Then you're really interested in the positions of the atoms or the heavy atoms, the ions. And for that, I would claim this is still okay. Because even if the plasma is hot, actually it's not so hot. Yeah? Because it is only as hot as your potential is deep by photoionization. The rest of the hot electrons you lose. So it's not so hot. And the ions certainly resist that. They are still more or less at the position if they are screened. You will see how much. They still also move. This I will quantify a little bit with numerical simulations later on.
I have a question on the ion shell outside the core.
Yeah.
So that structure is completely destroyed.
Yep.
Distilled.
Yep.
And for like the LCRIs,
what do you mean completely? I mean,
the structure is, that doesn't represent the true structure of the quote-unquote molecule.
It's a matter of time scale. I think at that time.
I
will show you. I mean, it starts to Coulomb explode, and it depends, of course, on the charge of the ions, how fast they move away. And on this time scale, they will already moved quite a, will have moved quite a bit. You will see that.
Yes, step three, there's the ion shell. So the structure of the ion shell completely altered, or
this one?
Yeah, the structure. I mean, comes up.
I mean, everything goes gradually, right? I mean, this is a continuous process, so you cannot say. Not what you can say once things are screened, then it really has slowed down and stays more or less like it is for a while. Yeah, but even the screened part inside has changed a little bit, because you cannot bring in the screening electrons so fast as you generate the positive repulsion of the ions. This you generate first by photo.
Well, but this rejoins what you said at the beginning, is that these ions which are ejected from the outer shells, the fastest ones will be the hydrogen ions, because they are,
if you have a non-homogeneous, this is first consideration for a homogeneous system. If it will be inhomogeneous, you will discuss for another 3 hours what happens. So we're good homogeneous right now. I assume it's a cluster right now, which seems to be complicated enough already.
No,
it's okay, sure.
It could also be, I mean, so at the same time you have kind of other information that comes out, right, from the field. I mean, you have some kind of elastic scattering of the X-rays. Do you have kind of harmonic generation in this cluster also, or do you have other things that come out?
It's...
But you just have mainly elastic scattering of the X-ray that you want to explore for the imaging.
So far, I mean, it's...
If you want to have harmonic generation in the infrared light sense, in long wave light sense, you won't have it here because it's incoherent.
It's incoherent, yeah.
Harmonic of what?
For the X-ray, I don't understand. Okay, so I mean, I could tell you how you quantitatively get the absorption. Maybe I leave that. Well, that's so simple. So if you have this charge sphere, right, you can think you have charged it. Critical field, yeah. Critical field. F critical for field ionization. So if we think we have this charge sphere, which has charge Q within the cluster radius, yeah. So this is the cluster radius. Then at the surface we have a potential, just Gauss law, because you can concentrate all your charge in the center, which is Q over R. And that means you have a field, which is Q over R squared. And this now we have to compare with an atom sitting here. Yeah. So now you have an atom sitting here, and this bound electron of this atom feels this field. And you now only have to compute over the barrier of the potential, yeah, of this atom sitting here, which is bent down by this field, F. And if you have an ionization potential, you want to lower your barrier so much that the maximum of this combined potential from the electric critical field, from your cluster charge, and the Coulomb potential gives you a maximum which coincides with IP. And this is actually the case for here F critical equals IP squared over 4 times the charge of your ion. It could be also an ion already here. And that's called the beta rule. I think Ulf mentioned that. Yeah. So you have simply to equate these two things. So you equate basically IP squared over 4C equals Q over R squared. And that tells you which charge your cluster nucleus must have for field ionization to set in. Yeah? And now you can make this as a charge basically per atom if your cluster contains n atoms. And this you can see, this will then be something like Ip squared r squared over 4z over n. And now you can replace n by the density, by the charge density, which is a general quantity, having something like n over v here. That's the density. You make this as unity, that's the density. Then this goes away. That's very bad, one shouldn't do that. So you have this little q, this is charge per atom, which is necessary, ionization potential squared. And this is the volume, it's just a sphere. So this will give you here 16p factor of 3. Z, and you have here r, because this is r cubed, the volume, here is r squared. The n goes away, and 1 over rho. And this is kind of the charge per atom you need for field ionization to set in at a certain density of your cluster. Huh? No, there's...
No,
it's okay. I divide by n on both sides.
Ah, okay.
And then I extend it, yeah, and this goes away.
Sorry, what's Z?
Z is if your atom is not an atom, but an ion, if it's charged already.
Oh.
Yeah. So take it to 1, and then it's just an atom.
And why is the V2, can you explain again, why is it factor of 4 over Z?
I think this just comes out if you calculate the maximum here, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I haven't done that, but it's just very simple. If you have minus z over r minus r times f, yeah, and you take the maximum.
One charge in that element. One.
It's a single electron, yeah. For an electron bound by energy Ip here. And so this gives you a dependence, roughly Q of R is 1 over R, and that I think I have here. No, I plan to have that. This is just very quickly, this is again an illustration how this plasma is formed. So initially you have just photo ionization, no potential, yeah, your electron leaves because your system is neutral or just singly charged. You take out more and more electrons, eventually you develop this positively charged center, and which makes this potential. So here the photoelectrons start to be trapped in this illustration, and here you create a plasma. And this I stole from ultra-cold plasma physics from Tom Killian. It's exactly the same thing. Here you have milli electron volts or something like that. Yeah, but it's universal. Anyways, but the time scale is very different. He has, I think, microseconds or nanoseconds for electrons. We have here something 10 times. And this is just an illustration for you from a true simulation from Jonas Argon 147. It's a cut through the cluster, yeah? You see the ion sitting, center one, that's the potential, so the center of, and these are electrons. And guess what? We can distinguish electrons because we do it classically, so we have red and green electrons. And this is to illustrate you that it's not so simple, this plasma, yeah? The red electrons are ones which are basically screening an ion very tightly. They could also be viewed as kind of Rydberg states, but you can't distinguish because all these electrons are thermalized as a whole, red and green together. Yeah. Still, the red ones will spend, and that's a distinction, at least 2 complete revolutions about one and the same ion before they hop again by some collision or whatever. Yeah. While the green ones kind of float through all the cluster. You can't talk about Rydberg electrons because all these electrons are thermalized. Yeah, how would you call them? They kind of, you know, they evolve about one and the same ion like 2 or 3 times. Normally you would call that a Rydberg electron, but since they have neighbors.
Sure, but then is it the electrons that are thermalized or the ion?
The electrons. The electrons are, and you have, this is very interesting because you have coexisting electrons at the same energy, yeah, which are really kind of screening an ion, revolving about an ion as a quasi-Rydberg electron, and ones which go through all the cluster, the green ones. That's how this.
So this is the energy of each of those electrons. In the
yeah,
electrons.
Yeah, exactly.
So the top green electron, some of those will eventually disappear.
Yep. absolutely. It's a cluster with 147 atoms, and you might wonder why we take 147. That's a magic number. You can look up on the web the structure. We don't have to do it ourselves. That's about it. And it's kind of spherical, kind of.
For Monte Carlo.
Pardon?
MD simulation.
Molecular dynamics.
So you already lost some electrons at the beginning. How many do you
have? I don't know.
No. I think it's a very nice illustration. And it says you can see the minima where the argon sits, and you get
in. Yeah, I get an idea. Oh, come on. Okay, so this is the illustration of our critical field. Now, as a summary, I think Ulf had it up last week in the conference, for all kinds of different electrons. So this is a cluster, a neon cluster at 12 keV. And you see here, essentially, the cluster size on top, or the cluster radius, which is of course equivalent. And this is the average charge, little q, I computed here, per atom, which is necessary to trap these kind of electrons. Yeah? So you see the field, ionized electrons you can trap first, q equals 1 and so on, for very small cluster sizes. Yeah? That's clear because they don't have much energy. And you just get them by this rule. And then you have the Auger electrons. You need a higher charge, background charge, because they have kinetic energy. Yeah? So you need a larger cluster to do that. And of course, as we said, the photoelectrons will also be eventually trapped. But you see, this is really a big difference at much larger cluster sizes at these parameters for the photons. OK. So I think this is more or less what I wanted to say over for this general scenario. All right.
Can I ask a question about the range of validity of this model? You start out with optically thin situation in whatever cluster you're looking at. So for example, if you keep the photon number coming in constant but drop h nu, when you cross the k edge, for example, then presumably this all falls apart. Can you be a little more precise, for example, as to what the range of validity is just in that connection?
You mean
come out of the X-ray region and go down?
You mean dipole approximation fails, or what means coming on?
Well, that's what I'm asking. How, under what conditions will this model fail? It's a very specific model, forming the slug in the middle with the charge. If you go to the extreme case of an infrared situation, it's a totally different
physics. It's not.
Obviously.
It's not.
Yeah. So that's what I'm asking. How far, what is the critical change in, in
so
energy?
If you go basically to longer wavelengths, or down in photon energy, good point. Then you're right. What happens eventually is we get the strong field regime, which we will hear next week about. And what happens then is that you have actually quiver amplitude of your electrons. So the laser field drags your electrons back and forth. Yeah, and this quiver amplitude. It's a characteristic length scale as of your radiation, So this quiver amplitude is given by F over omega squared, where F is the field strength or intensity squared, if you wish, of your light, on omega squared. Now you see, if you have very high photon frequency, this doesn't play a role. It's negligible. It's like what we have here in X-rays. If you go to infrared and have high intensity, this can be of the order of the size of your cluster. That means an electron, one of these electrons we are talking about here, is dragged back and forth through all the cluster and cannot localize at the center. And then, of course, this picture goes away. But it only goes away as long as your quiver amplitude is kind of comparable to the cluster size. So if you have a given quiver amplitude and you make the cluster a million particles larger, this will still hold again.
Then, of course, it will become more transparent.
Yes. Yeah, but this migration of charges is very, very general. So you can find it even in infrared. And we showed that, actually, by simulations. It can have that as well.
Yeah, but in that case, you have sputtering from the surface, basically, which blows the thing. And if you look at high infrared pulses, sputtering is the problem.
That's how you do laser fusion.
No, but what you have here is you generate a nanoplasma. I mean, you still have this nanoplasma, and you can drive it resonantly with an infrared laser, and that's the main energy uptake.
After it's formed, you're saying.
Yes. Yes. So it will be always formed because you always trap electrons. That's for sure, because you create positive charge. And that's kind of the main. But this.
You said that very clearly. The average charge is the charge
per atom in the cluster.
Per atom in the cluster. So if you go to the limit of what if you're below one, you're really below one, then you.
Every second, whatever.
Yeah. Then trapping won't work for you, so you need, like.
Yeah. Exactly. So for you see that here, I mean here it's calculated for these values for you need basically for neon you need for single charge one seventh, a tenth almost, only every seventh atom needs to be ionized to start field ionization. Okay. So the self-similar structure. That's a little bit of theory, at least. Well, maybe I get rid of that. I really didn't expect that this gives so much discussion, but that's great. Okay. Oh, you should leave that. I don't need it. Okay. So what we do now is we keep the ions fixed. Yeah, so do it for a relatively short time and look at electron dynamics. See if we can find something out about electron dynamics, which is again as general as possible. And of course, this requires certain simplifications, which you might not like, or you will certainly discuss, which is okay. So we take the same model. We just say we have a situation where we have a positively charged sphere. So we have all the ions, but we represent these ions as basically a homogeneous positive charge density rho. Yeah? And this has a certain radius, which is our cluster radius. Now this gives a potential. You can calculate it easily. V of r for an electron now being attracted by this positive charge distribution, which is q over 2r times r squared minus 3 if the electron is inside the cluster here, and it is simply minus q over r if r is larger, if it's outside. That's Gauss' law again. Yeah. So that means we have now a cluster potential which is Coulomb here, and then it's kind of harmonic inside, and here somewhere you have your cluster radius r, where this is Coulombic, and this is exactly again on the surface this potential q of r where we did our field ionization for. And now we try to do kind of universal or self-similar dynamics with this potential. I mean, self-similar dynamics comes about, as I said in the beginning, because the Coulomb force is homogeneous, and that kind of has the consequence that you have lots of scaling properties, very nice scaling properties. And it might be a bit surprising that you can do it with such a potential where this is no longer homogeneous, right? I mean, you have like your sphere and you have a harmonic potential inside and only Coulomb on the outside. But of course, and this is what we want to scale and bring in the cluster properties, so the size of the cluster. So now we have to scale, in addition to our variables, little r and momentum for the electrons, the size r of the cluster. Yeah? And that makes it kind of attractive. And moreover, we can bring in actually the pulse length, which will also scale accordingly. Now let's see how this works. So for that, we make first a simple model how we photoactivate. This is the name of the talk, how we photoactivate our electrons. Yeah? So we say we have now, I make it simple, I say I have as many electrons as the charges, so the system is neutral. That's not necessary, but it's simpler right now. And so normally we would first relax that to the ground state, again classical MD, so the electrons are somewhere in this potential, and now we apply a pulse. Yeah, we apply a pulse. So the pulse has like a certain intensity and time characteristics. It's just E0 times e to the minus t over tau squared Gaussian pulse. And now we can say what kind of charging rate this implies. Yeah, so we can say we have a cross section, of course, and the cross section times the intensity is kind of the rate of energy uptake, h bar omega, that's our photon, dn of t by dt. And we simply have to integrate over t to find out how many electrons in time are activated according to the cross section and the intensity of the pulse. Yeah? So we can do that. We just integrate that over the Gaussian. This will give n of t equals something like sigma omega E0 tau, doesn't really matter so much, these constants, over omega times the integral from minus infinity to the time dt prime I of t prime. Oh, I can take out, I took out E0, sorry for that. It's not very precise, I should leave that here because it's in here. And this gives you something which is an error function, incomplete integral, and I call that just an infinity, half 1 plus error function t over tau. And what does this mean? That means you have a charging rate, the asymptotic value of the error function is unity, and you start out with minus 1 with 0, I think. So you activate your electrons in time like this. Yeah? This is just the integral of the Gaussian. So this is what we do. And now we simply write classically, do that, our electrons as Hamiltonian, all interacting and so on, and activate them in this way with a certain excess energy. Yeah, let's say you assume you have I don't know, some photon energy, whatever, 90 eV, and you would have a binding energy of the relevant electron orbital of 70 eV. You would just give them 20 eV excess energy here according to this rate, so h bar omega. And now result of that is shown here. So this is just a general result, and you see here, you see the photoelectron spectrum, but this is a theoretical one. Also at negative energies, it simply tells you after the pulse is over what energies do the electrons have, all these activated electrons. And you see here different curves. So the probability for having an energy, and these are different curves for different clusters. These clusters are characterized by the radius, the size of the cluster, by this excess energy I just told you, yeah, basically photon energy minus binding energy of the individual orbital, and the pulse duration, t. And this is shown here for size, radius 26 atomic units, 10 eV excess energy, 10 femtosecond pulse duration, 13, and so on. And you characteristically always get two peaks. We can discuss that a little bit later, where this comes from. And apart from that, it looks quite different. But if you scale your energy axis and basically these three parameters in a certain way, and this is why you have these strange numbers here, all three curves fall on top of each other. And this is the self-similar dynamics which these Coulomb complexes entail. And I will try to explain to you now where this comes from. Okay, so what we have is, more or less, we want to say basically, you can take one parameter and then say, I want to know how the others change. Let's say we take the energy. We want to have excess energy of 10 eV, and we want to know what is the self-similar dynamics at 20 eV, yeah, which corresponds to exactly the same spectrum. And it turns out this is this cluster size and this pulse duration. Why this is the following. So we have a Hamiltonian, and we want to scale this Hamiltonian, scaled. So it is basically eta times the unscaled one. This is our goal. Yeah, Hamiltonian is the energy. Now, we can write our Hamiltonian in an abstract way. Don't want to go into too much details here as kinetic energy. So this is the set of all the momenta plus potential energy, which depends on the set of all the positions of the electrons. And let's say then minus this charging rate, which is a function of T over tau. And this goes with this excess energy, E star, shown here. So this is our Hamiltonian. And P now, P simply means that this is just P1 to Pn for all the electrons. Now, what are the individual contributions? The typical contribution for K is, of course, Pj squared half, yeah? And now you see immediately how I should scale the momentum to get out H here. I should scale the momentum basically such that I have P goes over in square root of eta times P, yeah? Because if I insert that here, then I see I get eta times P squared, and this gives exactly this scale. Now, this is more or less trivial. What is not so trivial is to do that for the potential, because the potential, yeah, the potential basically has these two terms, and I have that here, yeah? It's the Coulomb part, so I can write this as Vr, V of R1 plus would be the sum R minus Rj of the electron repulsions, yeah? Where the sum goes without, the comma means without J. So this scales trivially, it's Coulomb, that's very simple. But this is not homogeneous in the first place because we have had this kind of charged sphere. And in order to make that homogeneous as well, here we have to scale R, the cluster radius. And this comes in where the Coulomb scaling, you know, transfers actually now to a property of our system, to the cluster size. And that means I can now scale basically like this, eta minus R, eta minus 1, R1, and so on, eta minus 1, Rn, yeah, equals eta times Vr of, okay, I write R short here. So this is the first non-trivial scaling we have. And now I have also induced by the scaling for momentum and for position, I get a scaling of time, which is very simple to derive. Dr by dt is just equation of motion is p, as we know. And if I now insert our scaled variables, so eta times d tilde times dt equals eta minus 1 half p tilde, and R tilde are the scaled ones, then you see to make this equation of motion invariant, I have to scale the time, yeah, to time T tilde. And this time T tilde, by combining the eta's, is simply, if you bring that over, is eta 3 half dr over dt equals P tilde. And that means, of course, that T tilde equals eta minus 3 half times T. Yeah?
But what you're doing is exactly complex scaling.
I'm not doing complex scaling, I'm just doing scaling.
Complex sure. Scaling is based on Virial theorem, yes. I guess you're doing the same.
Yes, I mean, it's for any homogeneous system, you could do this kind of scaling.
Yeah.
And this is not, I mean, the fact that it works is due to the Virial theorem. And Virial theorem exists for all homogeneous interactions.
Yeah. You get exactly
the
scaling.
Yeah, but what you do not is you get now properties of your system. You scale properties of your system. Because if I have pure Coulomb dynamics, if I would include all the ions, of course they are also Coulomb. That's trivial. You don't learn anything. But here I have fixed basically my ions, yeah, with a cluster radius, and now these virial properties of my dynamics of the electrons go over to system properties of cluster size, pulse length, and excess energy. And that's...
Yeah, but you effectively skewed your nuclei because you increased the density. So.
Sure, this is what it means. You're absolutely right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Okay, so now we have this time scaling, and that means, of course, we also have now, the last thing is our interaction. We have to scale our time constant of the pulse length with the scaling. Yeah? And this gives us exactly now our result that our Hamiltonian, which is eta minus 1 of r, eta times epsilon star, and eta minus 3 half of the pulse duration, depending on the scale coordinates, p and r, equals eta times the unscaled one, r, e star, and tau, form of p and r. Oops. Okay, and this is the relation, yeah, which you can use to explain exactly this result, because you will see if you insert in here this eta factor, that's exactly equivalent dynamics, which is exactly the same. And this, what Sergey said, is more or less the case, of course. You can see if you have a higher energy, you need a shorter pulse length. That's kind of reasonable, yeah, and so on. And the system is smaller. So it makes sense if you think about how the scaling works. But this is basically really quantitative and gives you relations of pulse length and excess energy and so on. Yeah.
Just explain once more. I now understand that you only have to simulate one parameter set, and you can simulate all. But what exactly do you now simulate? Which kind of trajectories? You have this plasma. You start with an exact charge balance system, and now you have the pulse. You said you have this one Hamiltonian term that picks up something. But are we now talking plasma excitations?
No, good point. What I simulate is I put in electrons into this spherical potential, yeah? And I put, because I make it charge neutral, to make it simple, I put exactly n equals q electrons in here. And I relax these electrons so they give the ground state, yeah? You can do that by simulation, take out energy and so on. And then I activate these electrons along this curve, which I calculated here. And this is, of course, a continuous curve, yeah? And I do that now by rolling the dice, like always in MD. So you make a random number generator, and you know, so you put discrete, at discrete times, you put basically, if it's so on,
energy.
The electrons activate them. Yeah, excite the electrons and let them interact and go. And what will happen because of that is, it's really designed according to what should happen. You have initially a neutral system, yeah? So the first electron I activate will go, will leave the cluster. And the next one has already harder time and so on, yeah? And this is...
What's the zero of the energy scale now, the result?
This is bound, so the zero of the energy scale is this one, this line. So this is the energy, if you wish, this is the zero. That's the zero of the total potential, of the cluster potential. So these ones are really the ones you would observe, yeah? They are ionized, and these ones are the ones which stay in the cluster. These are the ones which we are talking about, which screen and so on, yeah? In the cluster center, they of course have a...
Superimpose the energy distribution for the ground state. Will it look like your bound peak, or will it look something different? So if I because your ground state also has some energy.
Yeah, it has a shell structure. It has more or less a shell structure. Surprisingly, that's true, right?
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, it's
classical.
It's a ground state.
But, yeah.
So this is.
So how does it look on this scale, on this plot? If you superimpose it here, how would that?
It's one peak in a for one negative energy.
Yeah.
It depends on the density of stars.
Is it? Because but your electrons are interacting.
Yeah, but what is plotted is the single energy of an electron, so it's the interaction with the binding potential of all other electrons, and that you calculate for each of the electrons, then you make a distribution. And then you get almost the delta peak distribution for a negative energy.
Okay.
So the
the scaling algorithm, when you use the function f in an abstract sense, I mean, it can be another activation function.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, what you see also here is, I think, this peak, because we have an activation energy of 10 eV for the basis spectrum here. You see, these are the first ones which come out. Yeah, they come out with the excess energy because they leave a neutral system. This is this little peak which is here left, and then they have to basically work against the positive background more and more. The next ones, therefore, they have less and less excess energy here, but more of them coming out. And this is, I think, what Ulf showed also last week. This is for different system. This was now xenon, also in the experiment of Thomas Möller and Christoph Burstedt, where they found these long tails in the xenon photoionization of clusters. And this is now basically the continuum part here of the spectrum. Yeah? Here the excess energy was 20 eV, and you see you can very nicely discriminate between these direct electrons which come out first. They are generated first here, direct ones, and the ones which come out later because they thermalize and you have a tail which is just above this threshold. And this is then the plasma tail here which comes out. And of course this can only happen because they interact in between before they leave, they collide and so on. Okay, so maybe come to the last part. This will be relatively fast, I think. This is...
Could I ask a simple question? I actually don't understand the scaling. You mentioned briefly the Virial theorem. In that case, in quantum mechanics, you just scale the length of a wave function, essentially, and then the kinetic and potential energies, the mean values, have the correct ratio of 2 or whatever it is one half. This is quite different than that, and I'm just wondering what it says about the model itself. I mean, not every model will scale.
No, this is a property of classical dynamics, because in classical dynamics you can scale momentum and position independently of each other. You're allowed to do that, in contrast to quantum mechanics, where the uncertainty, of course, yeah. And so that simply follows from that, yeah. And this tells you essentially.
There are no conditions at all on the little model you have for these of R.
Yes. I mean, the analytical form here, you see, I mean, the condition is that the scaled potential should be eta times the unscaled one, because my desire is to have the energy, the scaled energy, eta times the unscaled one, and potential is of course energy. So I have to manage somehow to get, by appropriate scaling, get out homogeneous linear scale eta times the unscaled potential. And that is of course not possible for all potentials or so on. But what I can do, I can of course always introduce a scale, and that's what I do here, and the scale is the cluster radius. And then it's possible, yeah, for essentially all. And this is what this does. Yeah. The same is true for the activation rate. Of course, here also have the time scale, and the time scale is now linked to the internal Coulomb dynamics, which has these scaling properties.
I have a comment. I mean, in dynamic the system, if they talk about self-similar dynamics, they often it's more like, okay, you have a dynamical system, you evolve it in time, and the state of the system at a later time can be scaled and reformed such that it gives the state at an earlier time. But here it's more like you have different dynamical systems with different system properties, and you can scale the dynamic of one of these systems to the system, to another system. It's not like the dynamics itself is self-similar, or am I incorrectly interpreting it?
The dynamics itself is self-similar, but you have other elements in the system which are not self-similar, and this is the potential and the activation rate, which contains constants.
So in what sense is the dynamic self?
I mean, the Coulomb dynamics has exactly your property. That is self-similar. If it would be purely Coulomb potentials. Yeah. But now, in order to make the whole system self-similar or mappable, you have to kind of transfer the scaling property of the Coulomb dynamics it's to like what's
you,
in there.
You take an equation and you de-dimensionalize it in such a way that you can have...
What means de-dimensionalize?
I mean, you scale it with this theta and you have something which doesn't depend on the dimensions of the system, right?
No, why does it not depend? I mean, the dimensions remain the same. I scale all coordinates in the same way. Okay, you could say if I go to a hyperspherical representation, I have only one scale, which is the radius, and that's the only one I have to scale. Everything else is... Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
So P, for instance, is not the canonical momentum conjugate to the position?
No, because, yeah, this would not be possible quantum mechanically.
Oh, no, I was just thinking classically.
No, P is the conjugate momentum. Why?
It does remain even with the scaling.
Yeah, because you scale time.
Yeah.
So I derive the time scale actually from the canonical momentum relation here. Yeah, I keep that invariant by introducing also the time scale.
Now also got from the electron energy distributions, of course, at the kind of electronic temperature, right, as a function of time, how that goes up. If the same situation would apply probably also to other plasmas of similar density, for instance, there's a very interesting laser-generated plasma and X-ray generation out of that, different scope, of course, but would a similar model apply for that situation as well? You want to see for a short pulse excitation, but now let's say it be visible light, how temperature evolves from such a Coulomb model, or do you think that the outset of what we need to describe the scenario, potential in a spherical cluster of the electrons which are already in a plasma state, that is very unique to this physical situation. The question is, in plasma physics, is that a more general scenario, or?
I haven't thought about that. I mean, certainly you have charged particles. So the basic dynamics is the same. Now the question is, what is actually the potentials you create by this short excitation in a solid or so?
For the difference, you have an external field, and if you scale that properly, so the period of that field, or the wavelength of your long wavelength field, and the strengths, and then you can also...
I think this could be highly relevant for that. For instance, we now commission an instrument, a laboratory source, where we shoot femtosecond optical pulses on copper, the copper band.
Yeah.
And if you could predict how maybe some yield and figure that the electronic energy scales with going between these clusters instead, and in particular the effect of radius, that could be interesting, optimizing towards a rapid transfer of energy.
So, and I think that was also the motivation for the experiments in the 90s, because we want to get answers out of these clusters.
So that's still that has evolved, and that's still important. But for instance, we get the hard X-rays out, so we need some tails that go to 8 kV. Some electrons must, the temperature must be if you could get that in the model.
But that's very different, I think, because your energy uptake is very different from the infrared, right?
But would it be a similar curve? I mean, your curve is very generic there. It's just
For instance, you can have resonance, huh? This might not be the case because you're far away from resonance, but I don't think you can model this. This is single photon absorption. If you drive with a strong infrared, you certainly do not have single photon absorption. Oh, we can talk about it maybe later. It's okay. So ion dynamics. So the first thing is to prevent this Coulomb explosion I had in the fourth point before. which sets in even earlier in this general scenario, you could, of course, bring in your electrons. And I think I do that here now because it's. And this is what I think what Ulf also showed in his talk. So I write down what this is for you. Oops, this is four. So what's shown here is basically, I think, neon 1500 exposed to 12 keV radiation over 10 femtoseconds, and I think it was 10 to the 12 photons. And what you see is two lines, and these two lines refer now again to our cluster. And this is if we make basically the inner sphere, which contains 50% of the atoms, and the rest contains the other 50%. It shouldn't be half, but okay. And then this line is basically 5% along here. That's the inner one, and this is the outer 5%. That's the outer line. Yeah? And what this tells you is, again, an illustration of this field ionization effect. So if you do not have field ionization, what happens in the course of time? So your peak intensity is sitting here. It's essentially that you charge your cluster. And of course, the ions repel each other. And you see more or less homogeneously, I mean, these shells explode. Yeah, if we take this as an ion shell and this as an ion shell, just virtually, they both explode pretty much in the same way. So this is, I think, the electric field, and this is really the charge density. Now, with field ionization, this is an illustration of what I told you, is you create basically electrons from the outer part of your cluster here. And they go inside, and they screen the inner part. So there is no field inside here, and there's no charge density inside here. So the inner part of our cluster shell stays intact now. Yeah? It does not move. And the outer one moves even worse, of course, because you have removed more electrons. It's more highly ionized. It explodes actually faster than here. And that's the effect. Yeah? What happens? And now, of course, you can try to quantify that. Yeah?
But of course, if you're talking about imaging, using that for stabilizing imaging, then the relevant measure is not the position, average position over surface of the supercluster. The relevant measure is the RMS displacement of each individual atomic position.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Yeah, so as Sergei said, the relevant measure is the mean displacement, and that's shown here. So this is the position of all the atoms, basically with respect to their initial position. And this is now not, this is for different pulse lengths. Yeah? So we have the same number of photons, but we make the pulse longer and longer here. And what you see very nicely, if we take the full cluster, and this is done here with field ionization without, I think, yeah. Then you see the full cluster doesn't show much difference. And this is because the outer layer explodes fast. Yeah. So actually, the mean displacement for the outer ions is higher, including field ionization, than without. Although the inner ones stay better intact, so overall, you don't win a lot. But if you consider only half the cluster, which is kind of the theory, poor man's temper, so we consider only the inner part, then you see a big effect, of course. Yeah? Then without field ionization, these inner ions explode almost at the same rate here, or lose their initial position, while with field ionization, they explode. That was your initial question somehow, John. But they explode much more slowly, yeah, as a function of pulse duration. Pardon?
Is it still mobile glass?
Yeah, neon.
But then I'm claiming that this is excessively optimistic, because every atom inside the cluster is in a very highly symmetrical environment. So now, if you start thinking about the local dynamics, if you strip out the outer electrons and replace them with, say, uniform background, that's your plasma, electronic plasma, right?
The electrons will go where the charges are, right? If there's a double charge, there will be more there. No?
Just wait for me. So you have you started by having, say, a central atom, which is a neutral, and say six closely packed atoms around it, which is a very highly symmetrical environment. Now you have taken out one electron from each of these atoms.
No, I have not, because it's random where I take out electrons.
Just as an example.
Yeah, but that's not happening.
No, but you have very highly charged. Nonetheless, you have taken these electrons. What happens is the forces which is being used on the central atom, because of the high symmetry of the situation, it's really highly symmetrical, will be much smaller than if you are, and that's it's what it is. Now, if you are looking at a molecule, right? So whenever you ionize, you always create much less symmetrical environment than in a global gas cluster, which is close to the closed band. So, and in that situation, you will almost always have a net force.
That's not true. It averages out. So we tried it even with molecules.
So I have a somewhat related question, but it's, I guess, a slightly different focus. Because it is a closely packed system, it also makes it, so to speak, a little bit difficult for atoms in the interior to move far, partly because there are...
No. That's simply not true. Look at that. Look at that here.
No, I mean, if you now look at
it, it's totally parallel.
Loosely packed system, there would be lots of...
But Robin, look at that. I mean, you claim that for this closely packed system, the inner ions have a hard time to move.
You know what?
This shell moves as much as this shell.
I think that they can move. What I'm saying is, if you now have a more loosely packed system,
yeah,
you have lots of empty pockets where stuff can move into more easily. Yeah. That's all.
That's Coulomb forces.
It's
Coulomb forces.
Yeah, so the distance are very big.
Yeah.
It's a Coulomb system. It's not too bad. I mean, there's six angstroms.
What's the difference? The initial distance is 3.5 angstrom.
It's not densely packed.
But it's homogeneously packed. That's maybe what you mean. In this case, it's dense or not dense.
So what you're saying is that the first space that we vacuum.
What?
But there's no space any of these atoms can move.
What means close?
Sure.
It's homogeneously, so it's close or not close. I mean,
it's weakly bound. There's no bond.
No.
Long interatomic distances.
Yes, it's six atomic units.
Yeah,
3.5
angstrom.
So
3.5,
yeah.
Three and a half.
But it's all long-range Coulomb forces, right? That's what you have.
Long-range Coulomb forces is not quite the same.
So meanwhile,
noble gas atoms have no directional interactions to begin with.
Yeah.
So now, if you're starting from a molecule, we do have directional interactions to begin with. So
yes.
Now when you ionize, you will ionize out, you will essentially strip valence electrons. Almost all the way. Once you flood the area before the electrons coming from surface ionization, the outer electrons and valence electrons will get stripped out right away. So you go from a situation which has highly directional forces, which has a magnitude of one, right, order of magnitude of one on atomic units. You strip these forces away, and you replace them with something which is essentially non-directional, which is essentially Coulombic forces. So I'm claiming that there will be very much redistribution of local forces on the order of one in atomic units if you start from a molecule. And there won't be such redistribution.
Okay, so maybe let's see. The last example I show you is CH4 clusters. How about that?
CH4 is also highly symmetrical. That's not
a cluster out of CH4.
Nonetheless, CH4 itself is highly symmetrical. Clusters of CH4 is also van der Waals clusters. So you're still in the high symmetry situation. Try starting from, say, ethane.
Okay? I don't know what it is.
Try starting from a molecule which is an internal structure which has directional bonds. And then I'm claiming that you will see much faster iron distribution. So
but the bonds don't matter, but you mean the different distances once you have charged ions.
So what the bonds don't matter. You have removed highly directional forces which held this thing together in a specific structure. You removed that and replaced it with essentially non-directional forces in once you ionize it. So what has to have consequences for dynamics? You have to, since you have changed the force, you have to start accelerating.
Yeah, the question is what the consequences are. I'm not sure that they're so big.
Very simple. So if you apply if you change the forces on the nucleus by something which is on the order of one in atomic units, right? One carbon atom in 10 femtoseconds will move by 5 angstroms. Five atomic units, so 3 angstroms. That's a consequence.
No, but you charge everything around.
Therefore
it doesn't move so much.
Directional interactions. You replace them with non-directional ones, which are essentially uniform. And that is changing the force on the order of one in atomic units.
I don't believe that, but you will try it. Okay, so maybe we take the last part. And so this was for the displacement, and you can do a real displacement now if you embed that in helium, right? So this is now a true temper. Now we have our true structure we want to have inside, and we include it in a helium droplet, 15,000 atoms. And then you see very nicely that, of course, if we have naked, the displacement is much larger, and this really works. This is what you expect. Yeah? And it works with helium only because of field ionization, because helium itself is transparent for the X-rays. So very last point is remove positive charges, and that's the CH4. You know what CH4 looks like? It's just a tetrahedron, so it has one hydrogen here, one here, one here, one here, and in the middle is somehow your C. It's a bit bad drawn, but doesn't matter. You know what it looks like. And so this is now a cluster out of CH4 with roughly 300 of these molecules. And at 1 kV in 10 femtoseconds, that's motivated by the experiment which Todd did at LCLS last beam time. And so you see what happens here. Essentially, you see the charge of the carbon core. And I should say what the carbon core is now, because now it's relevant, because you have different kinds of particles. So if you have your carbon atom sitting somewhere after a while, yeah. Then we make basically a sphere, and in the sphere, the radius of the sphere is determined, or the core, by the distance of the largest distance of a carbon atom from the center. This defines basically the volume of this carbon core. And now we plot basically the charge which this carbon core contains as a function of time. And this is what the pulse is you see here. And you see, initially, this gets charged quite a bit, but then it gets down again, and this is very surprising. So it got almost neutralized. Yeah. So during the pulse, it gets charged up to 250. That means, each carbon gets charged, but then after the pulse is over, this gets more or less neutralized, and that's very nice in a way. It happens maybe a bit late here, but that's another way to neutralize the atoms you want to image, because here they get now the electrons from the hydrogens, and the hydrogens become protons and they leave. And this is shown here, more or less. So the hydrogen atoms inside the carbon core. You see initially, of course, it's four, because you know, per carbon you have four hydrogens, and then this goes down, so you lose about one or two hydrogens within this area, and they just take away this charge, yeah, the positive charge, which you have created initially, of course, on the carbon through inner shell hole formation with your photon beam. And what does this mean? Maybe that's the last slide here, really, now again, for the Coulomb explosion. I don't have the displacement here right now, sorry, so that's only the radius, yeah, but I think it illustrates more or less what's happening. That's on the large scale. So this is our carbon, as I showed it before to you, CH297, completely. The radius of the outermost ion, it doesn't change a lot on the scale of atomic units. And this is a simulation where we replace all the atoms by carbon atoms. Yeah, all the hydrogens are now carbons as well. So this would explode much faster. You don't have this mechanism where the protons carry away the positive charge. And this is, if we would, this is basically shown the hydrogen atoms in this for the cluster. So these are the carbon atoms, these are the hydrogen ones. So they go away fast, and this is when you replace all atoms by carbon. And now if we enlarge that, because it's interesting, of course, to see what happens here really in time, so this is shown here, then you see pulse is again centered at zero with peak intensity. It certainly goes much slower, yeah, to this mechanism that the protons go away.
Can it be a bad guy?
Yeah, sure.
I'm claiming to be an existing optimistic. Because CH4 is very highly symmetric, so your equal momentum gets compensated and even partially compensated when you remove multiple hydrogens.
Yeah, but we remove only one or maximum two.
Yeah, when you remove two, when you already compensated 80% or 70% of equal momentum. So because they go with 109 degrees. Relative to each other, no matter which one, which two you remove. So now, if you do this experiment where you take three of them as deuterium and only one of them is hydrogen, I'm claiming that your carbon core will explode much faster.
You are.
What we looked at is what plays the role pushing out the hydrogen, whether it's a global effect or it's an intermolecular effect. And it's mainly a global effect. So it's a radial expansion. So what you can look at the direction the hydrogen is coming out. So it's not a repulsion on the molecule which dominates, but it's due to the fact that you have a strong charging of the whole system and you have a radial expansion of the molecule, of the protons. Mm-hmm. That's what matters.
So, yeah.
Molecular structure is not so important.
It would still be interesting to actually
break
this into account and
CH4 and see what happens. Yeah, sure.
We can do that. That's not so difficult to do. Okay, I think that's it, more or less.
The only thing that all this dynamic sets in actually after the power is almost over. So
yeah, this
doesn't be helpful for imaging because
no, this yeah, this would only help if you got to longer pulses for whatever reason, you know. That's true.
How long?
Ah, you see, 10 to 20 femtoseconds. Yeah, then this effect is big.
The simulation also then assumes that
it would go slower. Yeah, sure. You're right. But still, I mean, ion effects tend to be, of course, later. Yeah.
But if you have 100 femtosecond pulse, then it would have been moving in pulse.
Yeah.
No.
And we also did calculation right here.
Now, I'm also related to Sergey's point. And so far, the assumption, the big assumption is a homogeneous environment, homogeneous particle. But for biomolecules, most cases, it's inhomogeneous. So my question is, in homogeneous case, what modification you have to do to change your model?
None. Zero. This is over optimistically that we don't have to change anything, but nothing, nothing really deep or time consuming.
There's a local. It's not unit. The core is not a unit. There's a local kind of, as you said, non-symmetrical cases. So there could be local some charges distributions are not uniform, even inside a core.
Yeah, that's true, but I mean, you have to see what you really want. I mean, you want to first try to find mechanisms or dynamical properties at all which you might be able to use to kind of tame your system. If you start with very specific systems which are totally inhomogeneous or whatever, I don't think that you will find general principles. That's at least the way we proceed. I mean, I certainly take that as a very important point that we should go to there.
So you will find very general principles which only apply to homogeneous systems.
No, I don't think this is true. I mean, there will be some things or certain scales which certainly will prevail if you take non-homogeneous systems.
For example, just take an example of inertial cluster, which is half helium, half muon. The dynamics will be very, very different from what you get here, right?
No. You mean in the inner shell is mixed or just pure and core shell?
The right half is muon, and the dynamics will be quite different.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that doesn't exist.
Nonetheless, it is a fair model, for example, for protein, which is in a water droplet. It may be a fair model because you may have like the dense parts, like the protein part, can be concentrated on one side of. And what
have
been mostly here? So
it's
why not simply try to take a look at it? If you
no, that's
exactly
true.
The same
that's true.
When I'm completely wrong, there is absolutely nothing to worry about. If you get the dynamics which is drastically different, then there is something to worry about. So it's an easy test for you. So why not simply do it?
I don't know. Wow.
I would also a little bit comment that could be the problem that if you, I mean, in methane, of course, what can happen? I mean, you can form protons basically after ionization. But if you, and CH3, and of course the proton is much faster. But if you consider a more realistic molecule that you would like to image, say, then of course you have a lot of dissociation channels. And actually, Sergei has shown this in for the high harmonic case, of course. That means that
you don't need dissociation channels because you charge your stuff immediately. Why do you think dissociation channels are important?
The point is that I mean, if you have a steep potential curve on which you can, so to speak, excite an electronic state,
yeah,
then a fragment can be accelerated much more than hydrogen. I mean, as we saw in the case of methane, the dynamics could be faster than the hydrogen case or H2 case. So what I want to say is that if you can have a lot of fragmentations, which can be actually giving faster fragments than the hydrogen.
I don't think you have fragments because you charge your system very, very fast.
Or just the
Coulomb force is, I would think, dominating.
A very simple example.
If you really highly ionize the whole thing at uniformly, yes. But if you, I mean, I don't know, I mean, what the model really says, how fast now your ionization of a subsystem will be. Yeah. I mean, it's not that the model is not sensible. I just say that there could be complications like this, I would foresee. Because if you look at the mass spectrometry, you see a lot of dissociation channels. Yeah.
What mass spectrum of such an experiment? No.
No,
I mean,
I think that's a. You see also that the dissociation of a complex molecule, the dissociation pattern, It's not that straightforward that you would say that there's a simple system that...
But I don't see a connection between a dissociation pattern or dissociation dynamics and this problem of imaging and essentially Coulomb explosion.
Yes? You want to get the proton out. This was your claim.
Ah, you mean in the last part?
Yeah,
for specifically?
No,
okay. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay, I'm speaking of this part, just of the high of the proton taking away the positive charge. And what I wanted to say is that I would not see that it's necessarily the protons which are the fastest which will be coming out if you go to a different molecule than methane. This was my...
No, I would think whenever you have a good bond, I mean, you have an orbital which is shared between, let's say, the heavy atom and the hydrogen, then...
But in the real molecule, there is not an orbital between two atoms. There's an orbital over the whole thing.
Yeah, but the question is how you fill your core hole, right?
Sorry?
How do you fill your core hole?
That's what I'm trying to say, but it's very difficult to say which of these molecular orbitals will be responsible and which dissociative state you finally will reach electronically.
Yeah, okay.
And dissociation is not something which is just here you say there's always two atoms in the molecule, and then you just take away the electron between them, and then of course they will split apart.
Yeah, I still wouldn't see why dissociation is so important, but I see that the bonding, of course, is not as simple.
That's true.
The proton is dissociation.
It's ionization. Ionization. What? It's Coulomb explosion.
Yeah, but of a complicated molecule, not just of H2 or CH4.
But once you have charges, everything is simple.
when you ionize your molecule several times, one, two times, there is Coulomb explosion, which dominates over dissociation. Because then that's the way the nuclei are faster.
Yeah, when you talk about mass analysis of fragments, you mean a single molecule now exposed to the same radiation, right? Yeah, but now that's different now. Let's take an example. So let's take an HCN molecule, right? Mm-hmm. So and let's say you ionize, you multiply ionize it, and you ionize on carbons and on the carbon and the nitrogen, one ionize and hydrogen. So one, what you have created, it's, and the distance, CN distance is very short. It's much shorter than CH distance.
Yes.
So you have created multiple charges in a very close proximity. So in this situation, you will explode off N and CH fragment. You won't explode by the H fragment. So it's...
You have electron transfer.
Yeah.
But you're just saying that the Coulomb is going very fast.
That the proton will be the faster.
The proton will move faster, that's for sure.
Whether your CN bond will explode because you have created co-hole states, it hasn't filled yet, but still repulsive, but still explode, or whether you transfer charge to hydrogen and then explode off hydrogen. That's a question of time scales.
Well, but if you create two co-holes, one on the...
Yeah.
Well, that's...
But if you create singly charged...
The lower than creating one co-hole.
Yes, but singly charged HCN won't explode. It's perfectly stable.
Well, but that's...
So,
you're considering one molecule. Here, they're considering many. So this is a
protein,
you're looking at one molecule,
yeah.
One big
one. Yeah,
but
you create
much more holes.
So I agree with you, but if you have positive charge states, hydrogens are the obvious candidates for projection, but it may not necessarily be that simple.
Actually, this is even proposed by the experimentalists for markers, right? They want to look at the fast hydrogens coming out so in a biological molecule.
It looks quite desperate in the sense that now the pulse is already on the short side, 1XFL and 2C, it changes, and the tempering effect, it's not on a logarithmic scale, it's small. So seeing that, I would be rather pessimistic. Just to have you see correctly, the parameters you put in, the 10 to 18 or 19 watts per centimeter squared, corresponding to the 10 to 12 photons per radius of the cluster, approximately. What have you actually simulated? The entire.
Okay, here this is for the 1 kV, right?
Yeah,
so this is not for the 10, 12 kV.
I just want to make sure there's no flaw in the argument in the sense that all that energy is really deposited in the cluster, because then obviously the parameters would be much higher than at the other parts. It is. You know that you have the 10 to the 12 per unit area of your focal area and per pulse, but then you do have a term that says what fraction out of that energy is really taken up.
That's the cross section of the atom. That's the cross section of the atom.
Still, it's really these numbers that come out. So, but if you would take that. But what was the focus? The focus was cluster size, cluster cross-section, cluster.
No. That was the.
Well, it doesn't matter since you have area in watts per second.
I think they claimed they had intensities up to 10 to the 18 in the experiments. From 10 to 18.
Yeah, maximum.
I think the 19 we also can be for curiosity. I think that's a bit higher than what we could use in these experiments. But I think you would go up to 10 to the 17 to the 18.
Isn't it true that for the 100 nanometers, you get even about 10 to the 20?
something to 10 to the 18th or so, yeah. That's actually...
Micron-sized?
Yeah.
But
so it's actually going to go high, but with smaller cross-sections. Yeah. That's why I keep saying these numbers that are actually relevant. Even though it's not as tight as focus,
yeah.
You have much higher
cross. Yeah, you're right.
It simulates to some degree. But
how does it correspond to John Spence seeing a 2 kV nanocrystals in 70 femtosecond pulses and in a damage?
8 angstrom, you would see nothing here. This is a scale much smaller than 8 angstrom.
Is there any understanding? I think you're dealing with neutral clusters here at the start. Is that correct? Is there any understanding as to what the charge state of the initial cluster will do to affect the models that you worked up here? And I say that because under physiological conditions, all proteins are highly charged, positive or negative, depending on the composition of the residues present in the protein.
Oh, is that true? I didn't know that. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
highly charged.
It's a physiological condition, neutral pH and normal temperature.
If you're imaging it, it will be appropriate to count our expressions, so overall charge of the protein will be close to zero. Not exactly zero, but close to zero.
So you'll be the tamper.
Yeah.
But still, then there'll be an initial charge distribution within the system.
I think...
And it's a well-defined question. If I take one of these clusters and have a charge... Initially.
I mean, what will happen is that you trap electrons sooner, right? But also, I mean, if the positive charge, it's hard because they will not stay intact, right? If it's big positive charge, it will Coulomb explode right from the beginning.
Well,
I don't.
This probably means 20
per 5,000 atoms or whatever. That's irrelevant, simply irrelevant.
I have a comment on temper. I have thought about this, and also we had a talk actually last week on the temper. If you just purely from an imaging and deconstruction point of view, temper actually can cause a lot of problems because it's not a simple you can average out. It's unlike the crystal case. Crystal case, you have a solvent, the water molecules, doesn't contribute to the black, doesn't contribute to black peaks. Only the identical copy molecules identical black peaks. So that solvent is completely, it's not really seeing the black peaks. But in this case, we get a cocaine with the Brasham pattern. We get from.
Well, that's why we suggest a helium temper, because I think with the helium, you don't have these problems.
Well, heliums are less, right? The effect is less, because the.
You only,
Z is 2, so proportional to Z squared.
And you lose the electrons. That's why you want the temper. They go into this plasma, and then what you image is this whole plasma ball. Okay, but that's probably okay as a background. It's very different for water, because the oxygen in water, you certainly see.
But helium, is it possible to temper? You put some helium on the molecule? I think probably possible on your cluster, but eventually biomolecules, protein molecules.
Well, I think John Spence did that,
the
right?
The freeze, this was the problem. That you had this ultra cold helium droplets, but then you freeze your structure, which is also a problem, because you don't know whether the frozen structure is responding to the...
I think they did something with the water, not the helium.
No,
it was
helium.
Helium droplets, but then, as I said, then the problem is the helium is very cold, and this means that you don't know whether your protein is still the protein you wanted to look at. So you can do it with helium, but then only the price is the core temperature.
And it also seems that even though John Spence initially suggested the helium, I think essentially gave up on it for exactly that reason.
Yep. Okay. That's
the idea.
Sure.